It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Iowa Week on Iowa Public Radio. And all this week on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we're exploring unexpected Iowa. And this hour, Iowa's literary tradition. We all know that Iowa is home to a number of prestigious MFA writing programs, one in particular, and we will get into the history of the Writers' Workshop later this hour. But Iowa's literary heritage is long and rich. Historian Lauren Horton is here to introduce us to some of Iowa's literary pioneers. Hello, Lauren.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I know that you have some individuals that you want to talk about today. And you've done extensive research about writers in Iowa, and you've been introducing people to writers from Iowa for many years.
I have done that because I love to read them, so I want other people to love them too.
Well, let's talk about some of the individuals that you particularly enjoy. And let's start with Bess Streeter Aldrich. And she grew up in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Tell me about her.
Bess Streeter Aldrich is a wonderful author to read. She writes readable prose. Now, there are wonderful authors that write less than readable prose. Her books are partially about Iowa and partially about after she married and moved to Nebraska. But her three novels about Iowa are just wonderful portrayals of life in the late 19th and into the early 20th century. I think the most famous novel that she wrote was A Lantern in Her Hand, which began in Cedar Falls and then continued on into Nebraska. It's not autobiographical, but it's a wonderful portrayal of a pioneer family.
And I know that she focused on short stories early in her career and didn't really consider it to be a career early in her career. Just writing stories was something that she did, but she had to get serious about writing.
Well, she did. Although she married a banker, she still had to ultimately have an income.
Particularly after he passed away.
Particularly after his death, yes. Her two novels that are set in Cedar Falls exclusively are Song of Years and Miss Bishop. And Miss Bishop is rather perhaps the one best known because it was made into a movie. It involves a farm girl who goes to Iowa State Normal School, now UNI, in the first class. And she graduates, and then they hire her as a teacher. And her whole career is teaching at Iowa Normal School. Those two, Miss Bishop and Song of Years, as I say, are exclusively set in the Cedar Falls area. And they're just wonderful stories about wonderful people. You like the people, and you're happy after you get through reading the books. And I think that's important, that things are interesting, but you feel good after you're done. Why be depressed if you can read something that's happier, right?
When I was growing up, I grew up in Cedar Falls, so I knew about Bess Streeter Aldrich when I was growing up, but she's not particularly well known now. Her books have not endured, and that was one of the questions that a lot of people asked when I was a kid. You know, well, why aren't these books as popular as Laura Ingalls Wilder's books, for example?
I can't answer that question, but they certainly ought to be. I'm showing prejudice here. I think that her style of writing and the way she plotted and the way she developed characters went out of style, particularly during the 1920s, the Flapper era, and then the Great Depression. Other styles of writing and other ways of plotting and characterization became more popular. So she went out of fashion, and nobody has rediscovered her properly yet. I think that may come, but it hasn't happened yet.
Now, as a historian, what can you learn from reading these books?
The life that she portrays in Song of Years is a history book about Iowa at the time. The book A Lantern in Her Hand shows the effect of the Civil War, the war between the states, on families and people in Iowa. So really, I often, when I was a history teacher, had students read both of those for that reason.
Now let's talk about Herbert Quick. And this shows my ignorance, but when I was reading a little bit about Herbert Quick, I was surprised to see in a number of places people saying the finest portrayal of pioneer life in the Midwest of all writers. And I thought, well, why haven't I heard about Herbert Quick? I've read a lot of books about pioneer life in the Midwest. Tell me about him.
Herbert Quick was from Grundy County, and he has a wonderful trilogy of pioneers set in that county. The books are Vandemark's Folly, the first one, and I think, if I may enter an opinion, the best one. The second one is The Hawkeye, and the third one is Invisible Woman, but it takes the same place and the same people and carries them forward through decades. I think perhaps he's less well known because he didn't consider himself necessarily an author of novels until later in his life. He was a lawyer, and that was his occupation, and people reading didn't know him until later in his life when he wrote these. And I'm at a loss to know why he's not better known too.
Really?
I cannot understand why people who write good books, well-plotted, well-developed characters shouldn't be more popular than they are.
Well, in reading about him, he sounds like a man who felt like he had a lot to prove about himself. He was disabled as a child, but still had to do a great deal of hard work on the farm.
Right.
He was obviously very bright and became a teacher, but never had gone to college. And there was a moment in his life where he was teaching a workshop, and Carrie Lane, who later became Carrie Chapman Catt, so another very, very famous Iowan, refused to attend his workshop because he hadn't gone to college. And that hurt him badly, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And it was an unnecessary act on her part, which I think shows the kind of people they were. I believe that you can educate yourself to a point that's as good as if you have umpty-dundin degrees. And I think he did that, but she was going by the letter of the law, if we can say it that way, that if you didn't have the paper, it must not be there.
Well, and he tried very hard to pursue a higher education, but he just didn't have the means.
He didn't have the way to do it.
So when he was writing, when he was at the height of his craft, was he well-known? Was he popular, a bestseller?
I think not in the same way that Bess Streeter Aldrich was, to compare the two of them. She was thought of as an author, and her novels got reviewed. He had a hard time breaking into the author network kind of thing. And so ultimately, I think people, critics, believe that Vandemark's Folly is indeed an excellent portrayal of an immigrant arriving in Iowa, claiming land on the prairie, something that nobody was experienced in doing at the time, and then making a success of it.
Well, it's definitely on my to-read list now.
Good. Oh, I've accomplished something.
Let's talk next about a man named Hamlin Garland. Tell me about him.
Hamlin Garland was not born in Iowa, as Bess Streeter Aldrich and Herbert Quick were, but he did spend his formative years in Iowa, elementary school and on through what we would call high school. He went to the Cedar Valley Academy in Osage. He later on moved to Chicago, and he moved in literary circles. So he is better known to the literary world than the other two. His books are not cheery. He develops characters wonderfully, and he portrays activities accurately, but you just begin to wonder how anybody lived through pioneer life when you get done reading him.
Well, I think a lot of us do wonder that, Lauren. I think
those, maybe
seems to have some validity.
I don't think he exaggerates it, but he certainly gives the bad with the good. His books, his most famous books, are A Boy Life on the Prairie, Son of the Middle Border, Daughter of the Middle Border, for which he received the Pulitzer Prize, incidentally, and then a book called Maine Traveled Roads. Now, all of those are about Mitchell and Howard counties, where he grew up. Unfortunately, perhaps for this show and otherwise, my favorite book about his is set in Wisconsin, which is where he was born, but he left there when he was quite young. His description of the hard work of the people who first settled the Iowa prairies is unparalleled. It is just extremely good. And not only did I have students read that in history classes, but my history professors had me read Hamlin Garland's books as a true picture of the U.S. frontier.
Are there any other early Iowa authors that you think we should know about that aren't commonly thought of these days?
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. I think that everybody should read Phil Stong. He was born in Iowa, Van Buren County, and he worked for a time as a reporter for the Des Moines Register. And he just wrote voluminously, and he wrote a lot of short stories, and he wrote a lot of novels, and they're all just wonderful reads. They will never win Nobel Prizes for literature, but they're wonderfully interesting, and the people he writes about are wonderfully interesting.
You can't say that Iowa is necessarily more literary than another state. There are wonderful writers from everywhere, but we certainly have a lot of writers from Iowa. We are the place to go for modern writers in many ways, mm-hmm. and we seem to have this tremendous literary heritage. Do you think there's something about Iowa that made it fertile ground for this kind of literature?
I really do. I think that the first European white settlers that came here had a strong interest in education, and I think that they brought great literature with them. And I think that inspired a lot of young people in Iowa to try their hand at the same thing. The four that we've talked about are four examples of that, because they did not in any of these circumstances stem out of a literary family, but they had stories to tell and the will to write them, and they got out there, and they're wonderful resources.
Lauren, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure always to be here. Thank you, Charity.
Lauren Horton is the retired state historian of Iowa. We've been talking about Iowa's literary heritage, and we'll continue to explore our literary heritage this hour as Iowa Week continues on Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Iowa's literary heritage, and we know that many aspiring writers around the world dream of coming to the Writers Workshop at the University of Iowa. That's been a fact for a long time, so maybe it doesn't seem unexpected or surprising. But why Iowa? How did this happen? We're going to find that out. Lauren Glass and Marvin Bell are here to help us understand how the Writers' Workshop became what it is. Lauren Glass is an English professor at the University of Iowa. Hello, Lauren.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for being here. We seem to have a little noise on your line, so hopefully that'll work itself out here in the next few minutes. And Marvin Bell taught for many years at the Writers' Workshop. He's published many books. He was also the first poet laureate of Iowa. Hello, Marvin.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And so, Marvin, I know I'm not going to dig into the deep history of the workshop with you. We'll save that for Lauren when he gets back. But I am curious because there are other places to go in the world to become a writer, to hone your craft. There are more and more places like that all the time. What do you think makes Iowa City so special?
Well, you know, Iowa is genuinely an independent state. Just watch it go from blue to red to blue to red and so forth. We're an independent state, and I think it would have been hard to start the Writers' Workshop in New York City or Boston or San Francisco, where the distractions are so many more. Lauren knows everything about the history of writing in Iowa, but I'll say the one thing that maybe most people know, and that is the Writers' Workshop exists because of one person, Paul Engel. He was born in Cedar Rapids. He went to Coe. He knew how to talk to everyone. He was Rotarian in that respect. He could get money to support his dream. And he created the Writers' Workshop. No one really told him to do it. There had been a class that was called Writers' Workshop. But when the man running that, I think he went into the service for a while, and Paul was here, and he took over. He had written the first creative writing PhD thesis. I think it was a PhD. The first thesis for a graduate degree, put it that way. And he created the Writers' Workshop. And as you know, later on with Hua Ling, his wife, they created the International Writing Program.
Absolutely. And Lauren, I think you're back with us now.
Yes, I can hear you if you can hear me.
We can hear you now. That's so much better.
Great.
All right. Well, let's go. Okay. Before we get into Paul Engle and his legacy at the workshop, let's go back to the fact that in 1897, the University of Iowa offered its first creative writing class. And over the years, creative writing was just something that developed at the University of Iowa. Was that unusual for the time?
It was, you know, there were local writing clubs in Iowa and indeed in other places as well. So there were the students frequently had their own autonomous interest in, you know, both reading and writing poetry. And so there were certain responses to that in Iowa and in other places as well. It was more about writing themes and composition in terms of classes that were offered at the university, and this was frequently modeled on Harvard, where folks, the cycle was frequently that people would, certain students would leave, go to the East, and then bring back innovations here. And so there were, you know, writing classes here and there, but they weren't common until the 40s and 50s.
Well, and when I think about the classic authors through time, these weren't people who had gone to school to become writers. Was the idea that you could go to school to become a novelist a novel idea?
No, in fact, as Marvin will tell you, it was vaguely disreputable initially to think that you could go to school to become a writer. Certainly in the years before World War II, the idea was that you had to go out and have life experience, right? Go to Paris or go hunting or, you know, fishing. The Hemingway model was more preeminent then. So these were more like leisure and educational activities that folks did who were interested in writing. But there was not the idea that you would go to school to become a professional writer. In fact, quite the contrary. Writers avoided college.
Well, and was there a sort of stigma almost to the idea that someone would try to become a writer by going to school?
Indeed, there was. English departments were frequently seen as stodgy and conservative. They frequently didn't even recognize that the United States had respectable writers writing. There was more attention to European and British writers. There was a presence of writers on campus. This was spearheaded by folks like Robert Frost and Vaishal Lindsay, who would come and give readings on campus. Robert Frost famously called it education by presence. In other words, the writer being present there would enlighten the young students as about the nature of poetry. But the idea wasn't that you would go to school to become a writer. Once you were successful, you might occasionally visit to earn extra money.
So, all right, there were these creative writing classes that grew over time. How did that turn into the Writers' Workshop?
Well, it was actually the work of a number of innovative administrators, Carl Seashore and Norman Furster, folks who wanted to actually merge creativity and criticism and make writing what they considered to be a more rigorous and credentialable, I guess you could say, skill. And that happened in the 20s and 30s. And was as much about innovative administrators as it was about writers who wanted to have, you know, drama and art and various other creative endeavors to be present on campus and to offer advanced degrees in those skills.
All right. And Marvin, you mentioned Paul Engle, and many people credit him as the man who really made the Writers' Workshop what it is. I mean, he didn't come up with the name Writers' Workshop. It had been sort of evolving and coming about for some time. What did Paul Engle do that really turned this into something unique?
Oh my. Paul was a steamroller. If he wanted to get something done, no one could stop him. I can remember being in classes when I first came to Iowa in 1961 to be a graduate student bum. Paul would be in the room with Donald Justice, the only poetry teacher at that time, and he would get up in the middle of discussion and go into the back room and get on the phone, and he'd come back in, and this is a real example. He would announce the Iowa Natural Gas Fellowship that he had just arranged. He could get money from anywhere, and he knew, you know, he was a hotshot young poet who decided to use his entrepreneurial skills even more than his writing skills, though he went on publishing books. He is as responsible as anyone, more responsible than most, for Iowa City becoming such a literary center. Though I should say, if I may add two things, one is that Lauren is the great expert on this, and I want to recommend the film called City of Literature, where Lauren talks at some length about the history of writing in Iowa, not just the workshop. The other thing I want to add is that Iowa City, it's not just writing. As you know, as you well know, the Riverside Theater, the nonfiction writing program, the Summer Writing Festival, all of the printing that was done, you'll have more of this later, I think, when you talk about the Center for the Book, the printing that was started by Kim Merker and Harry Duncan and Kay Amert, all of those arts going on at once in Iowa City, of all places. Of course, our friends all think we're in Idaho or Ohio.
Well, Lauren, Marvin mentions money.
Yes.
and Paul Engel's genius for securing it. Was that considered to be a little bit gauche, too?
I mean, but that didn't stop him. I mean, first of all, let me thank Marvin for praising me and also recommend the wonderful movie City of Literature, which covers not only the workshop, but as Paul notes, also the Center for the Book and the nonfiction writing program, all of which in certain ways can be seen as not directly the product of Paul Engel, but enabled by his ceaseless entrepreneurial energy, as Marvin notes. He was a cultural entrepreneur, and these are folks who don't usually get the attention in literary history that famous writers do, but sometimes they're even more instrumental in enabling these sort of movements and phenomena to happen. And as Marvin notes, Paul did not see the division between art and commerce in the same way that other folks did. He was perfectly willing to, go talk to local businesses, to encourage poets to address, local businesses and to get money from them. So his entrepreneurial energies really were what sustained the workshop in the early years before it had the kinds of resolute institutional support that it has now.
Well, and we think about some of the very famous names to come out of the workshop and also some of the very famous names to teach at the workshop. I can imagine that really the money that Paul Engel was able to get invested in the workshop made all of that possible, too.
Absolutely. Paul essentially ran in the early days of the workshop, he ran it out of his back pocket. He got the funding himself for the most part, although he was in well with the administration. And so he was the instrumental in bringing, and he also was very sensitive to or intent on bringing famous people here, right? So Dylan Thomas came here in the early days, of course, Robert Frost, and other, Kurt Vonnegut. And so he was aware of the power of names, but he was willing to sort of subordinate his own name to the famous names of the people that he brought here. And he was a great believer in publication and professional writing. He did not feel, he did not support it as a sort of amateur or sideline activity. He wanted to create professional published writers and to bring famous writers here. And as Marvin notes, he was very conscious of the Midwestern location. He did not want a place like New York or Hollywood. In fact, he represented and proselytized for Iowa as precisely an alternative to the great urban centers. He celebrated Iowa as part of the Midwest.
And do you think that that was something that he really felt was valuable, or was that part of his genius in saying, you know what, nobody really wanted to come to Iowa City before, but look what we have, and this is what you wanted even if you didn't know it?
I think he was a true believer and a visionary, to tell you the truth. I mean, he was born and raised, as Marvin notes, he was born and raised in Cedar Rapids, and he had great allegiance to this area, and in fact, he felt that it represented a better America than New York or Hollywood, which he saw as sort of glitzy and possibly even sort of corrupt, although he spent a lot of time on the East Coast as well. But he also saw early the potential for small college towns to become what he called a community of writers. So he realized early what was going to happen to a lot of small college towns, which was that they would, in essence, replace or at least supplement New York, as we see in this recent book that just came out, right? MFA versus NYC. That was a pattern that he saw emerging early and was able to get Iowa established on the map before other locations would follow. And they all followed.
What were some of the early people who came to the workshop and had success and therefore spread the word? What are some of the people who this system really worked for in the early days?
Well, Wallace Stegner is probably one of the, and actually he came in a little bit before the workshop began, but then he started Stanford, and that would be a sort of another pillar in the pyramid scheme. Stephen Wilbers, in his book on the Writers' Workshop, has an actual list of all of the workshops that were started by Iowa grads, and it's virtually all of them, really, at the time. Marvin might remember some of the names better than me. University of Denver, Stanford, University of Michigan, UC Santa Cruz, started by James Hall, University of South Carolina, started by Dan Marin. So it's funny, you don't always know the names well, but basically a lot of Iowa grads went out and started programs along the Iowa model in the 60s and 70s.
And that created more competition for the workshop, but I'm sure it also, at the same time, enhanced its reputation.
Absolutely, and they would frequently route their better students to Iowa. Iowa has been at the top of the heap from the very beginning.
Marvin, did you have anything you wanted to add to that, how the reputation of the workshop spread?
Well, we were the only game in town or in the nation. There might have been one more, maybe a little program out at Stanford, but we were it for so long. And as Lauren points out, Paul had a genius for publicity and promotion as well as for the actual mechanics of creating this. A lot of people got published, and a lot of famous writers came to teach. And Paul, you know, Paul knew talent. He always knew talent. He hired people who were not yet famous but would become very famous. He selected students on his own. And we have the feeling that everyone who applies to an MFA program includes Iowa among their applications. I think at one point fiction was accepting 1 out of 30. And I know poetry was accepting 1 out of 20, 1 out of 15, and so forth.
And it's trickled down even to the high school level. We're doing a lot of recruiting of students now for the to come to Iowa as undergrads. But they already have their eyes on the Iowa graduate program. I mean, the reputation just continues to expand and grow. And I will say there's also one can distinguish between famous writers produced by Iowa and other administrators who then start other programs. Frequently, the people who run programs, like Paul Engel and others, are not as well known. Famous writers tend to either be visitors or on staff, or if they can make enough money, do something else. So, you know, Philip Roth came through here, John Berryman came through here, Robert Lowell, but they were not the people who stayed and ran the program. They were the big names that, that helped put it on the map.
Well, there are so many MFA programs now around the state of Iowa. There are some wonderful MFA programs around the nation. There are wonderful MFA programs, too. But the Writers' Workshop still has this mystique about it. And I had a funny experience when I was moving back to Iowa. I had lived in Michigan for 10 years, and I had announced that I was leaving Michigan and moving back to Iowa. And right when that news broke, I was also hosting an event at a writing festival in Ann Arbor. And people were saying, "Why are you leaving? What are you doing?" And then I told this room of writers that I was moving to Iowa, and there was this excited murmur that passed around the room, and suddenly everything was okay. Because, well, of course she's going there. Because
an ironic sort of compliment to that story where, you know, really the only reason people in the rest of the world have heard of Iowa City frequently tends to be the workshop, and it overshadows the English department from which it emerged. So when I say I'm a professor of English in Iowa, people are always initially, "Oh, wow, really? I've heard that's famous." And I'm like, "Well, no, not that one."
Oh, Lauren, thank you so much for being here today and sharing the history of the Writers' Workshop with us.
My pleasure.
Lauren Glass is an English professor at the University of Iowa. Marvin Bell, you're going to stay with us. And
yes.
Marvin Bell taught for many years at the Writers' Workshop. He's published many books. He was also the first poet laureate of Iowa. We're going to spread our sights beyond Iowa City in just a moment. We're going to talk about writing culture in Iowa more broadly, and we'd love for you to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Iowa Week on Talk of Iowa and River to River. All this week, we're exploring unexpected Iowa. And this hour, we're focusing on Iowa's unexpected literary heritage. And we've been talking about some of the pioneer writers in Iowa. We've talked about the origins of the writing workshop, the writer's workshop in Iowa City. Now we're going to turn our attention to the rest of the state as well. Marvin Bell is still with us. Again, he taught for many years at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He was the first poet laureate of the state of Iowa. And joining the conversation now is Robin Martin. She's coordinator for the Iowa Center for the Book. Robin, thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
Now, earlier in the hour, I was talking to Lauren Horton about some of the very early writers from Iowa, and he shared his thoughts about the fact that many of the settlers who came to Iowa valued education. They brought with them great works of literature. They read these books and, of course, then had some stories that they wanted to share themselves. Robin, from your perspective, where did this literary culture begin in Iowa?
Well, I would track it in the same way that Lauren has, that as these pioneers, the settlers, came west, they brought with them a high value that was placed on reading and writing and the books they brought with them. The settlement of Iowa moves, of course, from the Mississippi to the Missouri, and as it moves west, that tradition continues. We have in Iowa, as I guess Lauren mentioned too, 40 independent colleges. We have three great universities, public universities, and community colleges, and those have in turn become sites that can support creative writing and the literary arts and pass that tradition on. I think writers have to be supported, and in many cases they have become the creative literature writers in English programs across the state. But there have been so many writers in Iowa that have not come through university programs, who have taken inspiration perhaps from those authors, but who themselves have drawn deeply on their own traditions and stories. I think that's very exciting, too. We're continuing to look west from Iowa City for what was begun there and is so valued there.
Well, and let's go back still before what was begun in Iowa City, but let's talk about libraries around the state of Iowa, because we have some really remarkable public library institutions around the state, and we have a lot of public libraries.
Well, you know, when I think about perpetuating this literary heritage, we have a tremendous support system in the state, and libraries are right at the top. We've got 543 public libraries. You're stumbling across them everywhere you turn in Iowa, and they are deeply rooted and valued in their communities. And those libraries often host local writers. They are a place for research. I don't know of any writers who have not spent time researching and reading other writers, and they do those in their local libraries. Additionally, we've got some wonderful bookstores, independent bookstores, and in our project at the Iowa Center for the Book out of the State Library, we are trying to track those bookstores and small presses that are still supporting writers in Iowa. The bookstores, you know, everyone knows about Prairie Lights and its tradition of hosting writers that come through the Iowa City. The same thing happens in Des Moines at Beaverdale Books, which hosts, I would say, from 5 to 10 programs each month. It's interesting. They have their own bestseller, local sellers, or Iowa writers lists, and it's remarkable the kinds of writing that are out there. A very beloved author, I think, not only in Iowa, but James Autry, who started out as a poet, has written something called Choosing Gratitude, and it's still on the best seller Iowa writers list in Beaverdale. And One Summer America, 1927, Bill Bryson, we continue to claim him as an Iowa writer, though he's not here.
Oh, we can claim him.
Things like The Real Deal, which Bill Friedrichs has written about, an entrepreneur in Iowa, Bill Knapp. There's a lot of good nonfiction writing going on his Iowa history. And then something like Murder in Central Standard Time by Jody Verbiesel. Probably could be self-published, don't know. And then someone who's just taken an interest in local history, Riverview Park, The Lost Summer by Bill Cooker. So our bookstores, our libraries, our colleges and universities are helping us maintain this tradition. Writers groups throughout the state, you know, it is a lonely time, I think, writing, and many beginning writers seek help from those who are more established. And we've got any number of writers groups that spring up, and those are also hosted often in bookstores and libraries. One in central Iowa that has 25 members is the Published Authors Liaison, which was established by Wendy Del Sol. And Wendy is a well-known writer in her genre, writing for young adults. I think I wanted to mention, too, that for those writers who have not come up through university writing programs, they have many times taken a different path, and that is that they are writing for particular audiences, children's and young adults. But also we've got tremendous authors in the genres that I hope Iowans know about, as well as some as those that have gone through the workshop. But we've got some mystery, crime, and thriller writers out there of great note nationally and internationally. And I wanted to mention Ed Gorman, who's still writing from Cedar Rapids. He's written more than 40 books and still has a prolific blog on pulp fiction. And Iowa is often the setting of his crime stories. We've got Shirley Damsgaard, who's written dozens of books, and she, interestingly, is the past postmaster in Winterset. She publishes for Avon and Morrow. There's a fun group, I would say duo, in Des Moines called Sparkle Abbey, and they've taken their names from their pets. And they're traditionally published. Their titles are just great fun: 50 Shades of Greyhound, Get Fluffy, Desperate House Dogs, Kitty Kitty Bang Bang. These are just fun reads, and there are followers all over Iowa and the U.S. We've also got some great romance and realistic fiction writers.
And we just did a show with some of our romance writers a few weeks ago on Talk of Iowa.
And was Dorothy Garlock in that
yes,
group?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Such an incredible woman. And, I mean, known all over the world and translated into multiple languages and 50 million copies sold. These are people I want us to think about, too, as we
So look beyond the celebrated and those National Book Award nominees, which we have two from Iowa right now.
Yes.
And Pulitzer Prize winners and all of these really amazing authors. But there are a lot of other people writing and turning out great work that maybe don't get celebrated, but they certainly get read.
That's true. Another popular genre is the memoir. And we have a lot of memoirs coming out of younger Iowa authors as well as older. I mean, I always thought that a memoir would be written, you know, after you had experienced life. But it is a popular way of putting out the story of ourselves and our places and Iowa is a great setting and plays a role in many of those. Go ahead.
I want to ask both of you this, because now Iowa, when I was growing up, we had the highest literacy state or literacy rate in the nation. And I'm not sure where we stand on that list right now. But now, of course, that's the ability to read. But do you also think, and Marvin, why don't you tackle this one first? I know you tend to run in circles of people who read, but do you think that there is a stronger reading culture in Iowa?
There might be. I think Robin made a couple of terrific points about the libraries and the bookstores. Prairie Lights, of course, is run by two graduates of the workshop. I don't know. Iowa is in the middle of the country. Some good things don't come to us, so we have what we have. I don't know. I think it's been possibly easier to be in favor of education in Iowa than it might have been in some other places. So I don't know the answer, but we are high in literacy, and we do have the libraries, and we do have the communities, and so we read books. We may end up being the last town in America that reads books.
What do you think, Robin? Do we have a stronger reading culture?
Well, you know, I hope so, and honestly, it's up to us to ensure that that tradition goes on, that we pass on to our children and those that we're teaching and those that we're networking with the value that we place on literacy. I go to the National Book Festival each year representing the state of Iowa, and it is amazing how many people come to our table saying, "Oh, Iowa, do you still have the highest literacy rate in the country?" And I hope so, I say to myself, but we are known for that. And that value is something that we have to pass on and support in any way that we can. I'm concerned, naturally, as we all are. We're in this incredible transition into a digital world. It's difficult to know what that means for writing and reading. The formats are changing, but I certainly hope that we will continue to find ways to tell our stories and find ways to reach readers who want to share that with us.
Well, if you ask almost any writer for advice for a young writer, someone who wants to be a writer, they will say, first, be a reader. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I was going with that question, is I wonder if a strong reading culture is something that has led to this strong writing culture. I also wonder if maybe it's our cold winters that gives us time to look inward and be writers. What do you think, Marvin?
I'm sure there's something to do with it. You go indoors and you got to do something. But it's a very good point about reading. There's only one way to learn to write, well and better. You read something, you write something. You read something else, you write something else. But, and this is the secret, you show in your writing the influence of what you've read. So if we're a reading culture, we'll be a writing culture.
Robin?
Oh, absolutely. When I started to think about why is Iowa this reading and writing place, and I thought, well, we're the right size. There are not too many of us. There's not too much ego here. We're self-deprecating, and we have a sense of humor about ourselves. And yes, there are not so many distractions. All the reasons that Paul Engel thought that Iowa was the right place for the writer's workshop. We have time to imagine and create. We have time to read and write. There's still, as I mentioned, as people come by our Iowa table, great nostalgia for Iowa, and I sense a longing that people would like to be here and be part of what is still ours.
It's true, Charity. You came back from Michigan, and I decided to stay in Iowa City.
Mm-hmm. The publishing culture has changed dramatically. And Robin, you were going through a list of all of the many people who are writing in Iowa right now. I know on the Center for the Book website, you have a list of current Iowa writers that has at least 400 authors on the list. And some of them are self-published. And mm-hmm. we know that that has become a very respectable avenue now toward publication. With so many more books being published and e-published, self-published, and getting out there in different ways, does that maybe we have less great literature that's hitting the best-selling lists or bestseller lists, but does that just create more excitement, enthusiasm, and opportunity for writing?
I think it creates a lot of enthusiasm. Now, time will tell how many of these works are, you know, long-lasting, have ways of connecting to us, helping us learn who we are, why we're here. Great stories, great plots, characters we remember. But I think writers are having to work harder at getting their books and articles out there. There are many more ways to do that. It's a difficult time in the traditional publishing world. It's very difficult to find a good editor. I think editors are really the key to good writing as well, an important part anyway. I want to pay tribute to Ice Cube Press and the Iowan for continuing to, and the University of Iowa Press for continuing to publish really fine works by Iowa authors and about Iowa. It's hard to know what the future will bring. Again, it's really up to us to maintain that sense of values and pass that on.
Well, Robin, thank you so much for being here today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Charity, for focusing on writing and literacy in Iowa.
Robin Martin is coordinator for the Iowa Center for the Book. And Marvin, before I let you go, earlier in the hour, Lauren Horton gave me some authors to think about for my to-read list. And I know there have been so many great writers from Iowa. Are there a few authors with Iowa ties that you would recommend to anyone?
Well, let me go with the poets. And James Hirst, who was at the University of Northern Iowa for so many years, E.L. Mayo, Ed Mayo, who was at Drake University for so many years, Robert Dana, who taught at Cornell College for many years. There are a great many. And, of course, there were faculty poets here who were at one point very well known for their novels, Lance Borgeli, Harvey Castle, George P. Eliot. Philip Roth came through, Kurt Vonnegut, Nelson Algren, Richard Yates, John Cheever, James Allen McPherson, Robert Coover, Jose Denosa. One could go on forever.
And maybe read some Marvin Bell while you're at it. Marvin, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Marvin Bell taught for many years at the Iowa Writers Workshop. He's also the first poet laureate of the state of Iowa and has published many books. Iowa Week continues on Talk of Iowa and River to River. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe.